Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to the Liberty GB Weekly Roundup. I am the moderator. My name is Kel Fritzy, and I am joined by Tim Burton, who is the radio officer. Of course, we always have something to share with you, and this week we're going to be discussing apostasy. But, of course, I want to say hello to Tim Burton. Hello, Tim. How are you this evening?
Good evening, Kel. I'm very well indeed. And how are you tonight?
Not doing too bad. If people are interested in a little humor, though, my neighbor is raising chickens.
Oh, very good.
You can hear them clucking away.
Well, yeah, there's nothing more humorous than listening to clucking chickens in the morning over your next-door neighbor's fence, I have to say.
Well, she's getting her okay. This is really strange. She's getting her degree. She's working on her doctorate in bovine
chicken
agriculture.
Management. Oh right, okay.
Yeah.
Carry on.
So how come she doesn't have cows back there?
Yeah, I think we should be told. You know, there's. I'd be looking at that doctorate very closely if I were the examining the person who is going to be making a judgment on that doctorate. So, yeah, good question, Kel. I think we should keep a close eye on that.
Well, this is just a new development in the neighborhood.
I'm just waiting for my next door neighbor to start raising yaks. And then, you know...
A yak boat. No, it's funny. You're sitting in the backyard and you start hearing this, you know, clucking. You know, all these chickens in the chicken coop, they're clucking away. That sounds really, really naughty. But, I mean, that's what they do. That's the noises they make. They cluck. And you can hear them chattering back and forth. And it's like, oh, my gosh, chickens.
Yeah, so they make the same sort of noises over where you are that they do round our way, so that's quite good, that's quite reassuring.
Chickens, the international language.
There's a lot to be said for it, you know. I mean, you know, you could promote a sense of harmony and community cohesion by telling everybody they've got to start speaking in chicken. So, yeah, never mind. Anyway, I digress.
I took you down that path, Tim. I took you down that path by starting it up. But, no, in all seriousness, yep, she's a very delightful lady. She's wrapping up her doctorate in bovine agriculture, and she's raising chickens.
As you do, yeah.
Because everybody likes a chicken in every pot.
A chicken in every home. That should be our slogan, shouldn't it? Liberty GB, a chicken in every home, or a chicken in every pot. Yeah,
I think George Well and Paul Weston just fired us.
Well, I'll tell you what, there's been worse slogans, I'll have to say, you know. I mean, what was it that guy in America used to say? Change you can believe in. Now, I prefer a chicken in every pot. I think if I'd been in there in the last general election in the United States under that slogan, a chicken in every pot, I'd have knocked hope and change you can believe in out of the park.
Hey, you know, only two world leaders had their own slogan, Hitler and Obama.
All right, okay.
Did you know that? Well, I don't know if you knew that.
No, I wasn't aware. I thought that slogans were, you know, you could tie slogans to a lot more people than just those two. But there you go.
No, I mean, yeah, of course. I mean, every politician has their own banner and stuff like that. But Hitler was big on the slogan, and as is Obama. So I find that rather interesting. That's something we'll have to explore down the road. But let's talk about apostasy. And very interesting articles coming out of Liberty GB this week. And one in particular that caught my eye and Tim's eye is one written by Michael Copeland. And this is a woman who renounces Islam. Her statement, I renounced Islam, so my family think I should die. Now, obviously, English is not her first language, but her bravery speaks volumes, and it reaches us internationally. But, yeah, she turned her back on Islam, Tim, and now her family thinks that she should die. Now, this is the heading of an article in The Telegraph, and this was by Harriet Alexander about a British Somali woman named Amel Farah. Now, the article illustrates how readers' thoughts can be subtly steered towards desired conclusions. Both the journalist and the ex-Muslim, she quotes, have an interest in not directing the spotlight too strongly on Islam. They both know that this can be the excuse for repercussions. I find this rather interesting because The Telegraph is rather blunt and forthright, and they're not really intimidated by forces. But just the way that The Telegraph wrote this article, they really did couch their words rather carefully. We find this all the time when we're discussing the issues of Islam. It's almost as though the most bold become the cowed. And no offense to bovines.
Yes. I wasn't going to make any cow jokes on the back of that, but I understand what you mean. It's certainly true that we've been conditioned to a certain extent to couch our language in diplomatic terms whenever we're talking about anything to do with Islam. And it's quite possible that the person who was writing that article in the Telegraph was quite unaware of what she was doing. This is Harriet Alexander. And the article does go on to say that the emphasis in the problems that were caused were because of what her family thought. And the emphasis was not so much as what the doctrine is concerning apostasy in Islam, it's what her family thought. Well, okay, you might say that her family were perhaps particularly devout adherents of Islam, but nevertheless, the emphasis should be, and the Michael Copeland makes this point quite well, the emphasis should be on the fact that Islamic ideology is the driving force behind all this. I'm sure her family didn't just come out of the blue and decide on their own that she should be killed for what she was doing. I mean, families tend not to do that sort of thing out of the blue on their own. There's a driving force behind it, and that driving force is Islam. And we are far too cautious in the words that we use when we describe what is actually happening. And I think Michael Copeland is quite right to highlight this in the article that he has. But I'll pass that back to you and let you develop the article a little bit further, Kel.
Absolutely. And Tim, Michael Copeland is spot on with this because he brings this up the very first paragraph of his article. And he continues in saying, straight away in the heading, there are two influences at work. First, the spotlight is put on my family, quote unquote, influencing the reader away from supposing that the matter might have something to do with Islam. It is a family thing. This is a standard deflection often used. And second, the wording, say, I should die. This is a slightly vague and open statement, a whole lot less dramatic than I should be killed. That is fascinating writing, and how the Telegraph danced around that. I really do like the Telegraph, so I'm very disappointed in this reportage. I don't even know why they cover these stories if they can't come out right and say, that is what is going on. It's not my family. It's not that I should die. This is Islam, and I'm an apostate, and my family wants to fucking kill me. And pardon me. Oh, sorry, guys. I keep forgetting I'm on the F-bomb show. But keeping attention on her family, the article goes on to say her family felt she deserved to die. And there you are. It was what they felt. That's what they felt. Yeah, it's not that it has anything to do with Islam. Of course not. No, it's just a family thing, you know. And once again, the Western reader is inclined to consider that with some loving, kind encouragement, the family could be influenced to change their feelings. First feelings, then beliefs. They believe you deserve to die. The family believes this is what she deserves. Silently, it is left open to the reader to hope that with the right pastoral care, the family could be brought round to be more charitable and engage in humane beliefs. But, you know, nothing is offered to rule this out. And this woman could possibly very much end up in an honor killing. And this is what the Telegraph will not report. This woman is an apostate. She left Islam. Her family knows it. And they think she should die. And if they have an opportunity, I'm more than sure that they will kill her.
Well, it's certainly what the Islamic ideology demands. There are plenty of people out there who will say this is nothing to do with Islam, which is something we'll develop in later paragraphs in this article. But what they conveniently overlook is that every single one of the Islamic schools of jurisprudence, which define Islamic law. There are four schools of Islamic jurisprudence in Sunni Islam, and there are some more in Shia Islam. But the important thing is that when it comes to apostasy, they're all in agreement. And the agreement is that one who voluntarily leaves Islam should be killed. That is to say, if they've reached maturity and they're considered to be of sound mind, and they do not return to Islam when they have the opportunity to do so, then they should be killed. And this is actually, it comes from, there are various places in the, not so much in the Quran itself, but in the Hadith, in the supporting documentation. I'm thinking in particular of, Sahih Bukhari 9.84.57, which the Islamic prophet Muhammad is reported to have said, if someone leaves his Islamic religion, then kill him. Now, I'm quoting off the top of my head, so I think that's the right reference number. But this is actually all part and parcel of Islamic ideology, and it's quite misleading to suggest in the article that it was somehow something that her family got into their heads as if by magic, and they could be talked out of it. But then it does come down to not wanting to offend Islamic beliefs, which is almost drummed into us now that we'd rather do anything than offend Islam. Well, when I say we, I'm not talking about you and me, because we're only too happy to offend Islam.
Yeah.
In fact, if we get through a complete episode and we haven't offended any Muslims, then I don't think we're doing our job correctly. But leaving that aside, there are a lot of people out there who are so infused with the mantra of political correctness and multiculturalism that they will do absolutely anything to avoid offending Muslims, because they know that Muslims are sensitive souls and get upset very easily, so they go out of their way not to offend them. And this in my view is a huge mistake generally, because when somebody is engaging in antisocial behavior of this nature, and by antisocial what I mean is, if somebody has a particular belief that you don't like and you think they deserve to be killed for it, that is antisocial. That's extremely antisocial, and it should not be encouraged. In fact, it should be given very strict sanctions, and people who do engage in that line of thought to the point where they're willing to carry out murder just because of what somebody else believes or doesn't believe, that should be dealt with very, very harshly. And it isn't, because we're so afraid of offending Islam. Well, I'm sorry, but it has to change. But rather than go down this route, I'll hand the microphone back to you again and let you develop the article a little further, Kel.
Gets worse.
What a surprise. Carry on.
This is an article. This is actually a wonderful piece, and this is from the Liberty GB website, and the link is right there in the show notes, ladies and gentlemen. Please click on it, and you can actually even Google it if you're not in the chat room. It's I Renounce Islam, and it was written by Michael Copeland, and he is dissecting an article from the Telegraph, which was written by Harriet Alexander. And, yeah, just when you think it can't get any worse, it does, because the pressure is on, though, because we next learn it's not just the family, but the community. They share the same belief about leaving Islam. Within my community, that's a capital offense, and this is what this young lady is saying. They believe you deserve to die. This is more demanding. There will have to be much more persuasion work done with the whole community to help them modify their beliefs. Now, steady there, folks. There is more detail. In the eyes of the deeply conservative Somali community in which this woman comes, renouncing Islam was an act potentially punishable by death. Yes, okay. Now we know it is the deeply conservative Somali community. Okay, yes. You know what? It's only the deeply conservatives, you know, within the Somali community, you know, because renouncing Islam was an act of potentially being punishable by death. Of course, we know that, yeah. Now, that, everybody, isn't that better? Because it's only the deeply conservative Somali community. Let's all breathe a sigh of relief, shall we? It evidently does not include the presumed modern fashionable part of the Somali community. And besides, look again, renouncing Islam is only potentially punishable by death. Now let's all breathe another sigh of relief. Now that really takes the pressure off, doesn't it, right? She's adamant that it is not a problem with Islam. Oh, and there you go. You know, it's not Islam. No, she's quite convinced it's not Islam. It's that deeply conservative Somali community with its feelings and beliefs. And the only snag, though, is that the phrase, it is not a problem with Islam, has the ring of being a standard untrue disclaimer. This matter is indeed very much a problem with Islam. And I don't know if this young lady is in denial herself or if she is just acquiescing to the way the Telegraph portrays this article. But it is not just a family, it's a community, but it's only the deeply conservative Somalians. So, you know, ladies and gentlemen, you know, rest easy. It's not the wider Islamic society that has a problem with apostasy. Of course not, you know. It's only the deeply conservative Somali community. But they are denying that this is the very problem. It is Islam. It's not some wacko followers of the cult. It is Islam within itself. It is very much a problem with Islam, very proper. And Tim, I really find this report is a little disturbing.
Well, yeah. I mean, the first thing I'd say is that whenever you hear a spokesperson say that this problem has nothing to do with Islam, a little red light should go on in your mind and you should instantly think the chances are that it'll have everything to do with Islam. And there are far too many people out there, as I said before, who are willing to whitewash Islam and pretend that Islam has no faults, that it's perfect, and that if there are any problems, it's anything at all apart from the Islamic ideology that's at fault. And yeah, I think you're right when you say there is an element of denial in there. We'll have to read a little bit more down the article to determine to what extent the denial is part and parcel of what the Telegraph writer thinks or mm-hmm. whether it is more to do with what the Somali woman herself thinks. Certainly, you can read a great deal about the accounts of people who have suffered at the hands of Islam, and I'm talking about Muslims themselves as well as non-Muslims, and they will go out of their way to, even though they've suffered terribly, to say that the problems are nothing to do with Islam. You know, it's something they've brought on themselves. Maybe they offended somebody that they shouldn't have done. Maybe that they, you know, were in the wrong place at the wrong time. But they go out of their way to say it's nothing to do with Islam. And if you apply critical thinking and you work through all the relevant factors using critical analysis and scientific reasoning, which is really the only way you should treat Islam. There are three ways you can treat Islam. You can believe everything that Muslims tell you about it, which is problematic because they lie to you. You can look at what Muslims actually do and say, and analyze that using scientific reasoning and critical analysis. And I would suggest that's actually a better way to go about things because it allows you to develop a picture in your mind which has far more to do with reality than what Muslims actually tell you. Sorry, I did say there were three things. One is from the point of view of a devout Muslim. One is from the point of view of somebody who doesn't know very much but believes what Muslims tell them. And the third way is with scientific reasoning and critical analysis. And I would say that's a better way to look at it. But if you don't use scientific reasoning and critical analysis, what you end up with are situations where people make comments like this and they say, it's nothing to do with Islam. And you've got no way of really refuting it because you haven't applied the appropriate thought processes. And unfortunately, because of the sad state of our educational system today, there are very few people out there who have been trained to apply the appropriate thought processes to something like Islam. And yeah. So they tend to believe what they're told. And I certainly think part of the problem with the author, Harriet Alexander of The Telegraph, is that she has been fed a line about Islam, and she's constructing a story around that line. And when it comes to the Somali woman herself, yeah, I would think there's probably a fair bit of denial in there, because nobody wants to admit to themselves that their entire belief system that they've been brought up ever since they were old enough to start thinking, the entire belief system they've been brought up with is a complete and utter fiction. It's a lie. It's like The Matrix, the film The Matrix, where the protagonists start to realize everything that goes on around them and what they think is real isn't real at all. And that's actually a very good metaphor for Islam, because people who are brought up in Islam are fed a lie. It's a complete fiction, and it takes a very, very strong person, mentally strong person, to actually refute Islam and to recognize the truth of that when they reach maturity or get to an age where they can apply critical thinking. Very, very hard thing to do, which is why so few people do it. But coming back to the end of that paragraph, when somebody says it's not a problem with Islam, you can be pretty sure it most likely is. But anyway, back to you, Kel, and let you carry on with that article.
And one thing that the article picks up on is, while the pressure has been removed, we can be fed some handy distractions. And, oh, I love this. If you look at the Old Testament, there are some shocking things there. This is just another standard technique. You lot do it too. Known by its Latin name as tu cucu. You also. Two observations are called for. First, just because certain other people may do the same does not alter the moral unacceptability of the action. It simply means there are others just as reprehensible. No difference is made to the objection. Second, in this specific case, there is a flaw. The parallel fails to be a parallel. The Old Testament contains many old laws and accounts of killing. To adduce it to evidence is facetious. It does not form part of British law. The Quran is complete. It's a complete contrast. It's incomplete of contrast. It's all part of the Islamic law, which specifies the death penalty for denying any verse. And that is the manual from the Islamic law. Every command in the Quran has legal status. Similarly, every speech and action by Muhammad as recorded in the traditions accepted as reliable has legal status. And that shocks me. This is unbelievable. Yet they always throw that old chestnut in our faces. Well, look at the Old Testament. You know, you guys are just as bad. We reformed our Holy Bible. We reformed. We evolved. We do not engage in killing people. And Jesus Christ did not walk around he is the Son of God. He is the true prophet. He didn't walk around stoning people and marrying 9-year-olds or, 6-year-olds and sleeping with them when they turned 9. Jesus wasn't like that. Muhammad was. And whatever Muhammad says goes in the blind eyes of the adherents of this cult.
Yes, that's true. And there's a couple of other points as well that come out of that paragraph. Where people say, you lot do it too, and they refer to the logical fallacy, tu cuc, which means, as it says in that paragraph, you also. The Old Testament does indeed contain commands to violence, but the difference between the Old Testament and the Quran is that in the Old Testament, such commands were specific to a time and a location and a specific set of circumstances, and they were not an overall command valid for all times and all places. Now, in the Quran, the commands that we see are indeed valid for all times and all places. They're eternal commands, and that's the way they're understood. You quoted the manual of Islamic law, which I think is Umdat al-Salik, the reliance of the traveller, gives a good example of various laws and how they should be interpreted. And as it says in that paragraph, every command in the Quran has legal status, and it has legal status for all times and all places. And that's why it's so problematic when people say, well, the Old Testament is just as bad. They are not comparing like with like. The Old Testament was not valid for all times and all places. And the Quran is. And that's how it is interpreted by Muslims. It's how it's interpreted, going back to the schools of jurisprudence that we were talking about earlier. All the schools of jurisprudence agree on all the main aspects of Islamic law, and certainly when it comes to punishments like apostasy, there's no disagreement at all. And so when you have the death penalty for apostasy, you can say quite categorically that this is something that has that is valid for all times and all places, and as long as the Islamic texts exist, and as long as there are people in the world who take these texts as being the divine word of Allah, you're going to have these kind of situations where where families of women or of people who renounce Islam say the person will need to be killed because that is what Islamic ideology teaches. And so, it's quite wrong to have a comparison with the Bible, even though there is violence, particularly in the Old Testament, because it's not an eternal thing, whereas with the Quran, it is eternal. Anyway, back to you. I'll let you carry on with another paragraph.
Well, you know, they go on to argue that we're just as bad, and aforementioned that, well, we evolved, and the Jewish society, they realize that it's no longer acceptable to stone someone to death or cut out their eyes or enslave them. The vast majority of Muslims know this, and that they're not evolving with it. And this puts the Westerner reader at ease. Like, this is what they're saying. Like, it's just their belief system is justified because, hey, well, you know, we believe it too. No, we don't. We don't. We evolved. And what Agador said in the chat room, yeah, we walk on two legs now. You know, it's unbelievable to me, the logic that they try to spin on us. It's unbelievable. But all the same, Tim, I'm going to read this paragraph. This puts the Western reader at ease, but it is another of those we've heard them all before excuses, putting Islam on a par with Judaism. The vast majority of Muslims may have good qualities, but they realize what they realize makes no difference to Islam. Islam is not defined by what the vast majority of Muslims realize. Mm-hmm. Its teachings are derived from the Quran and the traditions, the hadith of what Muhammad did and said. As it happens, stoning, eye gouging, and enslavement, all of which Muhammad took part in or commanded, do indeed continue in the Islamic world. Although not normally reported by the mainstream media, they can be found on the internet, sometimes as with schoolgirls in Nigeria. Slave taking received some publicity. Yeah. It's only this... Yeah. See, they're trying... the mainstream media, what they're doing here is that they're obligated to report the sensationalistic actions of Muslims. But this is an everyday thing. This happens every single day within Islam. Like, if you don't believe what we're telling you, just Google the religion of peace and see the tally. They have the tally there every week, and they have a daily tally as well. People that are dying underneath this so-called religion, and Tim and myself, we do not believe it is such. Now, this woman leaving Islam, apostasy, that's almost like a swear word, you know?
I was going to say it's one of the worst things you can do if you are a devout, believing, professional Mohammedan. You have to believe everything that is in the Quran and the Hadith and everything about the life of the Islamic prophet Muhammad and his actions and behavior. And if it says in the Quran or the Hadith that there is a certain punishment for these things, then you have to believe it. There's no there is no free choice in Islam. Islam, as it says in this article, doesn't allow you to choose. If you're a true believer of Islam, you cannot choose what parts to apply and what parts to ignore. You have to take the whole kit and caboodle. And where it says in Bukhari 9.84.57 that whoever leaves his Islamic religion, kill him. I mean, that's an instruction straight from the horse's mouth, as it were, from the Islamic prophet Muhammad. And there is no choice about whether to believe that or not. You must, if you are a devout Muslim, yeah. You must believe it. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there are Muslims in the world who don't apply everything that is said in the Quran and the Hadith, and I suppose we should be grateful for that. But the question then arises is whether they are true Muslims or Muslims in name only. If they do not apply the Quran and the Hadith and everything that that entails 100% in their own lives, a devout, professional, believing Mohammedan could quite easily describe them as being apostates or guilty of unbelief, and apply the death penalty to them. And in fact, that is what happens in the Islamic world on numerous occasions. I mean, what we're looking at here is one article concerning one woman, and we're taking her story and using it as a case in point. But every day around the Islamic world, there are Muslims who are being killed for just this, for not being sufficiently devout, you know, maybe not praying five times a day. If that's spotted, you know, that could be a death sentence for you in some parts of the Islamic world. And the commands are not, you cannot pick and choose. And anybody who does pick and choose is not, strictly speaking, in the eyes of Islam, a true Muslim. But, I'm just throwing that in there for you, Kel, so I'll let you carry on with the article. Kel, are you with me?
Oh, sorry, Tim, I self-muted myself. I want to share this soundbite with everybody. And this is, what is the penalty for leaving Islam? And I'll play that right now for everybody.
Don't say that anybody who leaves Islam is to be killed. There's a law called Rida, which means apostasy, and that's exactly right. Your family has an obligation to execute you if you leave Islam. And if they don't do it, then they can be executed for not having done it or tried. Okay? So yeah, that's there. However, despite that, some extraordinarily brave people are so convinced of the truth of Christ that they are taking that risk. Some are being martyred. There are people being killed in, certainly in Saudi Arabia, certainly in Egypt more, because Saudi Arabia people are very, very afraid. But there are conversions there too, and there are pockets of Christians among the Arab population. And there are other places where it's going on. And they do get killed, but they become Christian anyway. And in fact, it was the execution of a group of, I think, 8 or 9 Trappist monks in Algeria that spurred the interest in Christianity among the Algerians. And that got them asking questions, and now missionaries are working in Algeria, Protestant and Catholic alike. And they're winning converts there. See, one of the realities going on in the Middle East is that the primary victims of radical Muslim terrorism are Muslims. Even ones who agree with them, but get in the crossfire. The number of people who are killed by the radicals are mostly Muslims. It's very sad. That is also getting them to think, why are we doing this to our own? Why are we blowing up mosques in Pakistan on a regular basis on Fridays when they get together for the day of the time that they have the main prayers at noon. And why are we blowing up Muslims in our own mosques? To show what? You know, this is a horrid situation. In Algeria, 250,000 people were killed in the fighting between the secularist government and the Islamicist opponents. And both sides did the killing, there's no doubt. But it was horrid. And this is, so that's making a lot of Muslims reconsider and, you know, take the risk of going ahead and becoming Christian.
And I found that rather frightening. And that was Father Mitch Pakwa. And I'm going to put the link in the chat room for everybody so that you can take a look at it yourselves later. And I'm just going to type in his name, Jeff. Did I call you Jeff? I guess.
That's okay. No problem.
And there we go. The link is right in there for everybody if you want to view that on your own a little later on. But Tim, it's what he said too is that we do understand the issues of Islam. There's a problem within Islam, and that Islamists are killing fellow Islamists. Muslims are not taking responsibility for this. So we have to. We are the vanguards, and we have to take care of what is going on within our own societies. This woman, she is an apostate. She is a resident of Great Britain, ladies and gentlemen. You know? Now, Sharia law, it has its own vigilante style of justice. The killing of an apostate can be carried out by anyone without penalty, since it is killing someone who deserves to die. That is also in the manual. We bring up the issue of Miriam Abraham in Sudan, a nursing mother who was sentenced to death for leading Islam, since her father, who abandoned the family when she was small, was Muslim. She was raised a Christian. She was raised by her Christian mother. Now, she has denied the charge, and she's refused to convert. She is brave. But, you know, in reality, the Islamic law, there is a problem with Islam. We know that. You know, the article itself mentions Muhammad, who said, whoever changes his religion, kill him. His word is Islamic law. What Muhammad said is Islamic law. Now, as a result of that, Tim, the one who has renounced Islam, the apostate, has to be killed. This is not something that Muslims may opt to believe or not. They have to believe it. If you are an adherent of this cultish entity, you must follow the word of Muhammad. And Muhammad did say, whoever changes his religion, kill him. How come that question does not arise in Islam, ladies and gentlemen? There is no freedom of religion within Islam. Muslims cannot choose. They are instructed. It is not fitting for a believer, man or woman, when a matter has been decided by Allah and his messenger, to have any option about their decision, and that is Quran chapter 33, verse 36. Islamic law indeed commands death for anyone who leaves Islam. Leaving Islam is the ugliest form of unbelief and the worst. And that is, of course, again, from the manual of Islamic law. When a person voluntarily apostatizes from Islam, he deserves to be killed. And we brought up the issue of Miriam Abraham, who was imprisoned in Sudan. She was not only imprisoned, she was pregnant, and her two-year-old, well, he was 20 months old, so he's going on 2 years old now, was imprisoned with her. And she was not only imprisoned, she was shackled because she was brought up a Christian. Just because her father was a Muslim does not mean that she would have to follow the dictates of Islam. But the family sought her out, and what they did to her and her husband, her Christian husband, who's an American, by the way, is we cannot let this one go. But this is what the mainstream media does. They publish the sensationalistic stories. Well, you know, everything about Islam is sensationalistic. Everything we read about Islam is sensationalistic. This is sensationalism in our faces every single day. And for the Telegraph, of all publications in the UK, to take this story and sanitize it in the manner that they have is unforgivable. This is irresponsible reportage at its best, or at its worst, if you like. Tim?
Yes, I'm in full agreement with everything you say about the way in which Islamic events are reported, and that they are reported in a sensationalist manner. Because for one thing, if you're trying to sell newspapers, having sensationalist articles can be quite useful. And just taking a dispassionate look at the goal of a newspaper editor might be, it might be that he wants to increase the circulation of his newspaper, and if he's unduly sensationist, well, the newspaper owner might not totally agree with the way in which things are laid out, but if it sells newspapers, it goes a long way to mitigating things as far as an editor's concerned anyway. But you are quite right. There is a point of principle here, which is that can go only so far, and being sensationalist is one thing, but there is also an obligation to tell other sides of the story and to tell the truth of the matter when it comes to, well, let's just take this one example, when it comes to a woman being condemned to death for apostasy by her family. It's not just her family that's decided this matter, it's Islamic ideology. When they're saying that her family says she deserves to be killed, it's not the family saying. It's what is written in the Islamic texts, Bukhari 98457, Umdat al-Salik, the Reliance of the Traveller, the Manual of Islamic Law. Comes from the primary texts, which are the Quran, the Hadith, and the Sirah, which together make up the Islamic trilogy. And if it's in there, it's Islam. Conversely, of course, if it's not in there, it's not Islam. And that's why I always say to people, it's not rocket science. You can go and read the source materials yourself and determine if something is or is not in those source materials. And if it is, it's Islam. And if it's not, it isn't. And we have a duty, an obligation, to bring these facts to the attention of we have an obligation to bring it to the attention of our listeners. I would argue mm-hmm. that in the case of some a respectable publication like the Telegraph, they have an obligation to bring at least some of these facts to the attention of their readers, and they rarely do, because to draw attention to the unfortunate realities of Islamic ideology could be a career killer for a lot of people. I'm not specifically singling out the Telegraph, but in a lot of industries and sectors, like, for example, education, local and national politics, to speak these uncomfortable truths could literally result in you being out of a job overnight. Now, I don't have such constraints on me, which is partly one of the reasons I say the things I do. And I wish that more people could feel free to come out and say these things, because it's only through telling the truth. Who was it who said, "The truth shall set you free"? That's a famous phrase from somewhere, and I haven't got it at my fingertips, but it's nevertheless true. We should always tell the truth, especially with regard to something as pernicious as Islam. Because Islam has only got as far as it has in the Western world because Muslims routinely lie about it. That's the only reason. Generations of Muslims have lied to generations of non-Muslims using the Islamic doctrine of taqiyya, which I'm sure most of our listeners will have heard of by now. The Islamic doctrine of taqiyya allows Muslims to routinely lie to non-Muslims in order to promote Islam or to prevent Islam being denigrated in the eyes of non-Muslims. And this is a routine thing that Muslims do. It's not just under special circumstances. In fact, there are circumstances where if the Muslim cannot achieve the desired result by telling the truth to promote Islam or to prevent it from being denigrated in the eyes of non-Muslims, he is obligated to lie. That's an actual obligation. And when I say an obligation, what I mean is, for a Muslim, in the eyes of Allah, it is not a sin. Now, we in our Judeo-Christian civilization consider telling a lie to be a sin. All right, many of us do tell lies, okay, but nevertheless, the concept is that you shouldn't lie because it's a sin. Well, that concept does not exist in Islam. It's perfectly acceptable to lie to non-Muslims, and it's obligatory to lie to them if you can't achieve your goal by telling the truth, and it's a permissible goal. And certainly making Islam look good is a permissible goal. And that's why Muslims lie about Islam all the time. And if the truth about Islam were widely known, it would crumble into dust. It cannot stand on its own two feet. It cannot withstand the disinfectant of sunlight. It cannot withstand people using scientific reasoning and logic and critical analysis to discover and explain the truth about Islam, which is why Muslims go out of their way to try and shut down our precious freedoms, including freedom of speech. This is why they do it, because they know that Islam cannot stand up to critical scrutiny. And I know that we are not likely to learn the truth from newspapers like the Telegraph. We're certainly not likely to learn it from mass media outlets and mainstream media like the BBC. But we can
absolutely
inform ourselves, and we can learn the truth through alternative media sources. Now we have the internet, we have social media like Facebook and Twitter, we have blogs, websites that are devoted to telling the truth about Islam. And all you need to do, ladies and gentlemen, is just open your eyes and take a look with an open mind. The truth is there. It's right in front of our eyes. And all we need to do is to understand that truth for ourselves. And then we need to explain it to all the people that we know, all our friends, all our relatives, people that that you might meet during the course of your day, people that you chance acquaintances if you have an opportunity to talk to them. Once a critical mass of people understands the truth about Islam, then the game will be up for Islam. It will not be able to spread anymore. It only spreads because there is a concerted effort to keep us all in the dark. But back to you, Cal.
You brought up the issue of Islamic jurisprudence, and yes, there are four of the leading schools of such, and that they all agree that apostates should be killed, and some hold that a woman would be shut up in a house and allowed to die through starvation. And there was a case of a teenage Muslim girl in Uganda who embraced Christianity and was very nearly starved to death after being shut in a room with no food for weeks. She became blind, unable to walk, and she was reduced to a near skeletal state, weighing less than 20 kilos or 44 pounds before being rescued. Sharia law is not quaint old stories from centuries back. It is harsh and unforgiving and is being applied in Islamic states. In Britain, it is being called for and implemented vigilante styles like Ajim Chowdhury and his followers. This is being called for in Britain. This sort of thing is being called for by hate preachers like Ajim Chowdhury, who I cannot understand is not under arrest, and who, by the way, gets council housing. This person, this creature, is calling for this. He thinks that this is A-OK fine and that this should be implemented in Great Britain. And Tim, this is shocking to me. This person is running about and he is declaring that, yes, Sharia law, this is what we want. This is the same person that encourages Muslims to kill soldiers. This is the same person that is living off your tax dime in Great Britain, ladies and gentlemen. And he is saying that it is fine. He wants it called for. He wants it implemented in Great Britain. And you know what, though? Liberty GB will not allow that to happen. And believe me, there's going to be a huge change in the political landscape come the general elections next year. Right, Tim?
I'm pretty certain there will be. You can, as it was famously said, I think by an American politician, you can fool some of the people all of the time. You can fool all of the people some of the time, but you cannot fool all of the people all of the time. And sooner or later, we are going to see a seismic change in the British political landscape. I actually have great confidence that it's going to be sooner rather than later, because the British public are largely due to the efforts of organisations like Liberty GB, they are waking up to the realities of what is actually happening. For many years, the three main political parties in the UK, Labour, Liberal Democrat and the Conservatives, have comfortably propagated the same old myths. And when there has been a general election, it's one of those three organisations that have, in the last 100 years, that have managed to secure the seats in Parliament in order to propagate those myths. But when we are faced with an existential threat to our society, our civilization and our way of life, when enough people realise that, and they realise that the three-party system that we've been, I use the word, enjoying very in inverted quotation marks, when there's an existential threat like Islam to our civilization and our way of life, then it becomes obvious to people, I think sooner rather than later, that the existing three parties are totally unfit for purpose, and we are going to have a revolution of some sort. Now, I personally hope that we will have a revolution at the ballot box that will allow sensible and sane policies to be implemented in order to constrain and control Islam and bring it down to a point where it is no longer a threat to our civilization and our way of life. That would be my hope, if we could get it through the election or through a regime which supported the goals that Liberty GB supports, then well and good. What I'm concerned about is that our political elites will go out of their way to keep us all in the dark until it is too late, and we won't be able to have the peaceful revolution that I envisage, in which case our children and grandchildren are going to be in for a very rocky ride indeed. And to see exactly how rocky, I would invite everybody who's listening to Google Tears of Jihad and see exactly what happens throughout history, without exception, when Islam gains a foothold in a society, and see exactly how it develops and what transpires. Because that will be our future if we cannot get a peaceful revolution that I would hope for. But back to you, Kel.
We are wrapping up this article, and we'll be wrapping up the program in a few moments, but the conclusion of this article, this I'm going to read verbatim, because it's a wonderful article by Michael Copeland. And for our archive listeners, I just put the link to that article right in the show notes. So our archive listeners, you can click on that and read the article for yourself. This, of course, is from libertygb.org. But the conclusion of the article is, The woman, the subject of the article, Amel Farah, is courageous to have renounced Islam. She is more courageous still for making it public, which she was inspired to do by the case of the Christian mother in the Sudan jail. And, of course, we are talking about that lady who was jailed, Maryam Ibrahim. We can all salute her courage. May she be joined by many others. And if you want to read more articles by Michael Copeland, please click on libertygb.org. But one thing that we can assure you is that we are not mainstream media. We are the new mainstream media. We're taking these old horses and we're putting them back in the stable for retirement, because people like Tim and myself, and people like Paul Weston, Michael Copeland, we speak with you about the true issues. We get to the bottom of things, and we bring you the truths. What the Daily Telegraph did with this story is unforgivable, in that it whitewashed the true issue, and that is Islam. This is not a family that was upset, and, oh, this has nothing to do with the wider Islamic society. Yes, it does. It has everything to do with Islam. This is Islam each and every single day. And you have idiots running around like Ajim Chowdhury, hate preachers, saying this is what we need to do in Great Britain. No, it's not going to happen. And believe me, Liberty GB will not let that happen. And I'm going to read you their mission statement, as I always do at the end of every show. Liberty GB will address all the political issues Great Britain currently faces, something the three main parties, along with UKIP, so conspicuously fail to do. The Liberal Democrats, Labour, and Conservatives manifestly refuse to discuss the most important issues of our time, namely mass immigration from the EU and Third World, the steady rise of fundamentalist Islam, and the hijacking of traditional British culture and institutions by well-organized left-wing progressives. There is no guarantee at such a late stage that Britain can be saved, but Liberty GB will endeavor to put a stop to our rapidly accelerating descent into economic, educational, moral, cultural, and social ruin. Britain could be a wonderful country again, but it will take politics bordering on the revolutionary to achieve this vision. If you are of similar mind, Liberty GB welcomes your participation, and the link right there is in the show notes, ladies and gentlemen. That is libertygb.org.uk. Tim, I want to thank
yes,
you.
Yes, indeed, Kel. That's really good. I mean, I'm always impressed when I read the mission statement of Liberty GB. And I just wanted to one of the things that you said before you started that was, I intend to retire all the old horses to the stable. Well, I was thinking of taking quite a few of those old horses and taking them down the knacker's yard and turning them into dog food, starting starting perhaps with David Cameron and Tony Blair. But I don't want to pursue this too much at this point in time, because I'm sure our time will come. But all I would say, ladies and gentlemen, is when Liberty GB finally take charge and restore sanity to the British landscape, then if you have any shares in glue factories and dog food, you should hold on to them, because they are going to go through the roof. Back to you, Kel.
I was going to say we actually have a caller who wants to come on the air and join us. So before we do close out, let's bring this caller on, because he's been sitting here rather patiently for close to 5 minutes. And 1673, welcome to Liberty GB. What's your name and what's your comment?
My name is Chris. And
hi, Chris.
Hi there. I just started listening in, and I'm from America, and I have a question. How do you feel over in Britain, how do you guys feel about our president releasing 5 Taliban members who are very dangerous? Is that something that, you guys think of and are worried about?
Yeah.
Because, of course, these people are going to go out and do terrible things. I just wanted to see what you had to say about that.
Yeah, Kel, do you want to take that, or would you like me to?
Oh, Tim, I think this is yours to take.
Okay. Well, first
and thanks
of all, good
for
evening.
The question, Chris.
Okay, yeah, thank you, Chris. Thanks for joining us and thanks for asking the question. I think that a lot of people here on the radio shows that especially conservative and patriot radio shows like this one have got very strong views about what happens in America. And I can't speak for everybody, but I think the consensus of opinion is that it's absolutely appalling what President Obama did when it came to the exchange of five dangerous Taliban prisoners for one American soldier. Now, I know Obama is trying to spin it as saying, well, we never leave any American soldier behind. It's too bad that he didn't take the same line, of course, when it came to Benghazi, when he left the ambassador and the Marines that were guarding him to die a horrible fate at the hands of insurgents in Libya. I'm personally appalled that he took that step, quite disregarding all the relevant rules and laws that have been put in place, whereby Congress should have been given notice, should have been consulted, and so on. Once again, he's ridden roughshod over the American Constitution and American laws in order to impose his will, and he's not even making good decisions. Every decision that he has made, as far as I can see, has been against the interests of America and in the interests of our enemies. And I can't wait to see that man removed from office. It can't happen quickly enough for me. Now, I'll pass the microphone back to Kehl, but I can assure you that there's a lot of people over here in the United Kingdom who feel that way about this particular set of circumstances. Go on.
Can I say one more thing? Like you said, we never leave a person behind, but we also have a saying that we never negotiate with terrorists.
Yeah.
And that was a terrible negotiation. No, five, and this guy allegedly deserted his troop, like his group, so, I mean, it's a questionable thing. I don't think we should have done that, and we put the whole world in jeopardy by leaving these people out, and I was going to say that how many of our troops, and probably your troops as well, have died trying to capture these five men? And then
Put
them back
out
there. You know,
you're absolutely
trying to get them.
I'll pass that over to Kehl to address that. I'm actually in perfect agreement with you, Chris, but I'll let Kehl elaborate on that because I know she's got a couple of things she wants to say about that.
Well, what we did is that we released five Taliban senior back into the bosom of the Al-Qaeda movement. And when they were exchanged, what happened is that there was a stopover in Qatar before they moved on to probably Afghanistan, and they were treated like they were treated like rock stars. And what we're going to see, Chris, what I fear is that they're going to be back. They're going to be back on United States soil, whether it be them or their foot soldiers. What we're going to see is that there's going to be something devastating, probably within a year, maybe 2 years, and it's going to hit American soil, and it will be because of what Obama has done. Barack Hussein Obama is going to be responsible for this. And where will he be, though, when he is ousted from the White House? And Chris, I'm very shocked that he negotiated with terrorists.
And the way that he's been acting, it really doesn't surprise me that he would do that, but it's not allowed by the Constitution of this country. And, you know, I don't know why he has not been impeached already, and this should at least do it. And, you know, I said when this happened that if any blood spills, it's on his hands. And
absolutely.
One of the
Kel. Sorry to interrupt you, Chris. I was just thinking that we might actually develop this. I don't know if you're in a position to perhaps call back in one of our other shows, Chris, because this is an extremely interesting conversation, and it might well be worth developing it when we have a little bit more time, because I know that Kel needs to be wrapping this show up shortly. Myself and Kel produce a couple of other radio shows, and if you like, I'll let Kel give you the details, and we can maybe pick it up on one of the other shows, because it is an interesting topic, and it does need discussion, and it does need airing. But I do know that Kel's looking to wrap up the show tonight, so I'll hand it back to you, Kel.
Yeah, Chris, if I could give you a call privately, maybe later on this week, we would love to have you back on the program to discuss this in particular. This is absolutely shameful that Bowie Bergdahl was exchanged for five Taliban, senior officials, and plus to the Bergdahl was a deserter. Six American soldiers died looking for him, and he was aligned with the Taliban. And what really disgusted me was how his parents were in the Rose Garden, the people's house in the Rose Garden, and the father was speaking Arabic and saying, "Praise Allah."
That bothered me, yes.
Yeah. But I do have your number. I would love to give you a call later this week. We would love to have you back on the program. Is that okay if I give you a call?
Yes, give me a call. I have my own Blog Talk Radio tomorrow. So tomorrow from 9 to 10 I can't. But anytime other than that I can call in. I'd be glad to. Go ahead and take my number down.
Fantastic. You have your own show on Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, it's blogtalkradio.com/keepingthemhonest, and I cover current events. This
Fantastic.
Week I'm having a guest on, a guest who will speak against the education system here with Common Core. So other than that, I do current events.
Wow. I am looking you up. I would love to listen to your program. Chris, this is has been absolutely fantastic, and I will definitely be in touch with you. And let's set something up and further dissect this, because this is probably the worst thing that Obama's done. I mean, never mind, Benghazi was. But there are so many things about this usurper-in-chief that we could dissect, and this is the latest. And this man never stops, and I don't know, short of him meeting Dexter, I don't know how we're going to keep him under control. He is totally undermining the integrity of the United States every single day, it seems now. But Chris, I want to thank you so very much for calling, and I will be in touch with you, definitely.
Thanks for having me on. You have a great day, both of you.
Yeah,
Thanks
for calling in.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, Chris. And there you go, Tim. That was, wow. This is definitely something that we have to explore. And I am very pleased that Chris called in. And Chris is the radio host of Keeping Them Honest, heard right here on Blog Talk Radio. And he has a show tomorrow evening. So, folks, check that out. Tim, I want to thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Kel. It's been a great show, and thanks to all our listeners for tuning in, and I hope you'll all join us again next week for another episode of Liberty GB Roundup.
You've got it. I will be I'll be speaking with you tomorrow, Tim, and tomorrow we will be RSB Radio WOW, and our guest tomorrow is going to be Sunny England and Glenn Saffer of the newly formed British Patriot Alliance. And so you might want to take a note of that and tune in and listen to us. So there you go. Ladies and gentlemen, Tim and myself, thank you so very much.
Yes, thank you, Kel. And I look forward to speaking to you tomorrow. And good night to our listeners, and see you soon.
You bet.
Mm-hmm.